Well, pledge team begins planning the October fun drive.
Hey, who took the last jelly donut?
Okay, everyone. It's time to plan our October pledge drive.
So how many days? I say we do the usual 8. What do you say?
Let's try something different.
Like?
Let's make it shorter.
We still have to raise enough to pay for the programs. I want people to have the services they expect from us.
It'll work. We can ask people to help by mailing a gift before the drive begins.
Hey, the website, willpledge.org. We can ask people to pledge early online.
I know. We can build a member match fund, then use it on air to encourage other listeners to make their pledges.
I like it. You guys work out the details. Now, where's that donut box?
Stay tuned for further details on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. I expect now that there are a lot of people who will know the name of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. She was in her time well known, very well known, for that book and for also being involved in the movement against slavery. However, in her time, she was not the only famous member of her family, of the Beecher family, and there might have been another contender for that title of best known. In fact, a man who in his time was one of the best known, one of the most famous Americans, well known also as an abolitionist for his advocacy of women's rights, and certainly well known as a public speaker. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk about this man, something, learn something about his life. His name was Henry Ward Beecher, and our guest is Debbie Applegate. She has recently published a biography, the first full biography of Beecher to come along in quite some time, and she titles her book The Most Famous Man in America. It's published by Doubleday. It's out now in the bookstore, and certainly you can take a look at it if you're interested. Debbie Applegate has a PhD in American Studies from Yale. She has written for publications ranging from the Journal of American History to the New York Times. She has also taught at Yale and Wesleyan universities. Dr. Applegate, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I'm glad, always on this program, you know, I'm always glad to have the opportunity to learn something new. And here I am learning a lot of things about Henry Ward Beecher that I did not know before. I'm sure that there are some people, others, who might, for his time, be contenders for the most famous man in America, including Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln. But certainly Henry Ward Beecher, in his time, in the middle of the 19th century, was a very, very well-known figure and a very influential one as well.
That's right. He was a minister, but it's hard now to think about a minister being a celebrity in quite the same way that he was, because we live in a different kind of culture. But as a minister, he was also a political activist, also a gadfly, a cultural gadfly who had his nose in all kinds of opinions and all kinds of issues, ranging from, you know, whether women should wear bloomers to high White House politics. And he was also an entertainer, one of the very first in the modern entertainment industry, who made a small fortune going on public lecture tours around the country. So he had a kind of cultural cachet that is hard to picture now for someone who is a man of the cloth.
Yeah, and that would have been a time when going to hear people speak, people like him, would have been a form of entertainment. And certainly that there were people like Sam Clemens, for example, who and many others who made a pretty good living doing just that, traveling around the country. Or maybe in Beecher's case, a lot of people came to see him at his church.
Both. I mean, really, the spread of the railroad is what made the lecture tour a viable, exciting entertainment opportunity. You know, really, back in the 19th century, there were not that many respectable places to go. If you were, a good woman or a good Christian man, you know, you wouldn't go to the theater, you wouldn't go to a billiards hall, your music hall where there's liquor being served. You could go to church, and people did go to church for entertainment, but you could also go to lectures. Everyone could afford to go to a lecture, pretty much, and everyone could enjoy it. And Beecher really, you know, he became the most famous orator in the country for many years, partially because he had both an Eastern kind of education, an eloquence, but he also went out and did much of his training out in Indiana and Ohio, where he got a really good wild Western flavor from preaching at camp meetings and riding the circuit from small town to small town. It was that combination of West and East and his own flamboyant, funny personality that made him so unlike anybody else.
Yeah. His father was a well-known minister, Lyman Beecher, and he had Henry came from a big family. He had, I think, four sisters and six brothers.
12 kids altogether. One was lost in childbirth, as was so common then. The Beechers, his father, last great Puritan minister, really the man who was the most famous minister before Henry, his sisters, even more famous than anyone else in the family in many ways. His sister Catherine Beecher remains famous for being a female activist on behalf of women's education and a writer. And, of course, Harriet Beecher Stowe was really the Dan Brown of her day. Uncle Thomas Catlin was really the Da Vinci Code in its tremendous popularity. And his little sister was a women's rights activist. All seven of the brothers went into the ministry.
Yeah. The father, Lyman, apparently it was important to him. He wanted all his sons to be ministers. And it seems that it would have to be the case that in many ways Henry's career and his personality, not surprising, were shaped by his father, perhaps in more correct to say in opposition to his father and his worldview and his kind of religion. Because what Lyman sounds as if what Lyman Beecher was all about was the wrath of God, and what his son Henry was all about was the love of God, and in fact that may well have been the key to his success as a preacher. Was a very different, for the time, a very different kind of idea of what the relationship between people and God was.
That's right. That's very perceptive. That really is, of all the things we can say about him, that is probably his greatest accomplishment. That he really led the popular transition from a post-Puritan, Old Testament, fire and brimstone, God as a capricious ruler, a capricious king kind of model, to what we now think of as Christianity. Even in fundamentalist churches, they still talk of Christ as your friend, as a healer, as someone who will help make you happy here on earth, as well as get you to heaven afterwards. And it was nicknamed by people the Gospel of Love. Some people, his critics, called it the Gospel of Gush sometimes, but it just was tremendously powerful to 19th century Americans, many of whom had been scarred by being raised like Henry was, with that fear of the devil and fear of hell burned into them.
He came from this, as you said, he came from this big family, and I think that probably all of the Beecher children, the men and women, the girls and boys both, went on to do important things. And again, in their time, two of them, particularly Henry and Harriet, were very well known. Yet also there were two of Lyman's sons apparently committed suicide. You know, you'd have to wonder what exactly it would have been like to grow up in the Beecher household.
Well, one of the things that was lucky for me as a historian was that the Beechers were classic Victorians in that they wrote everything down, or if not everything, plenty. They left tons of letters and stories and histories. Henry and Harriet, in particular, were very fond of turning to their childhood in their writings. Harriet would fictionalize it as part of her novels, and Henry would talk about it as part of his sermons. So we actually know more than you might think about their childhood. You know, one factor that is kept impressing me over and over and over again is how much every family had to deal with the potential loss of a child, or oftentimes many children. Henry and his wife Eunice themselves had 10 children and lost 6 of them. So, you know, so you can see why you might focus on life after death, why hell might really seem to be a real fear, and why heaven would be a real goal in a way that's very different.
In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking about the life of Henry Ward Beecher, and our guest for the program is Debbie Applegate. She's authored a new biography, The Most Famous Man in America. It's about his life. It's published by Doubleday. It's out now in the bookstore. He's someone who, as she has explained, in his lifetime, was very well-known, very famous, well-known as a speaker, was involved in the abolition movement, and since then, though, has lost some of what was the fame of his time to his sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, who was certainly famous in her time as well. But now since, it seems that I think that for a lot of people, you say Henry Ward Beecher, oh yeah, he was Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother, right?
That's okay. Right.
And then that's about all we have to say about him. And I think that Debbie Applegate was interested. Part of the reason I think for your interest in doing this story was simply to try and restore him to the place that he once had.
That's right. He's like, you know, it would be like not knowing who Ben Franklin was or Ralph Waldo Emerson. In some ways, Beecher was so quintessentially American in all the best ways, irreverent, iconoclastic, but had a conservative instinct as well as a bold manner. And on so many subjects, he was very funny in a way that shocked people. He made jokes from the pulpit. He was the first person to bring flowers into church, which shocked people. And I think not knowing Beecher is sort of like not knowing Ben Franklin. Like, gee, we know less about ourselves as Americans for not knowing who he was.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that really strikes me, particularly if you think about the approach to Christianity that he had and that his father had, you see very much the same kind of family dispute, really, that goes on within Christianity now between people who are on the more liberal end and who are on the more conservative end. I think really in a lot of ways that today's Lyman Beecher would be in harmony with many of today's religious conservatives, and in the same way that I think now people who are sort of more on the liberal end of the spectrum would be more in harmony with Henry's ideas about God and love, and we're still that conflict seems still to be going on within Christianity as much now as it was then.
That's right, and you can really see it as it in it's as the way it combines with politics. Actually, people forget that the anti-slavery battle was as much a religious battle as it was a political problem. You know, the Constitution has slavery deeply embedded in it, or had slavery deeply embedded in it. Thank you. We've now taken that up. But the Bible, if you really look at it, the Bible is full of slavery. Some of God's most favored subjects are slaveholders, and in fact, slaves are seen almost as a reward for being a pious worshiper. And there are books like Leviticus where it is actually prescribed that you can hold slaves, and at no place is slavery forbidden. So one of the ways in which Beecher entered the debate and was so important there was he said you don't have to be a fundamentalist, a strict interpreter of the Bible in the way that you describe, like many conservative Christians who read the Bible literally. He was very, very strongly argued that, you know, the Bible is a living document and is meant to be interpreted. And if you look at what Christ said, that Christ's message supersedes the Old Testament approval of slavery. And, Christ preaches equality for all. And that was a huge argument to make, since half the reason why people could not get motivated to work against slavery is because it seemed biblically sanctioned.
And apparently, in as much as now we should acknowledge the fact that he was an important figure in the abolition movement, I think there were some people also who say he was a little late. He came a little late to the cause, and perhaps was insufficiently militant about it. That he was much too, at least for some people's taste at the time, he would be much too accommodationist, much more too gradualist, much more saying, well, this is a bad thing and we have to deal with it, but we need to kind of go slow.
That is absolutely correct. He had a reputation as a radical, but he was less of a radical. He was not like a William Lloyd Garrison, who was willing to repudiate the Bible and the Constitution because they included slavery. Henry Beecher, he was more flamboyant That is actually the better way, even though his message was, well, let's go a little slow. We don't need to have a radical break. We don't need to court civil war. But his tactics were incredibly colorful, incredibly shocking. He auctioned off young, beautiful slave women from his pulpit in Brooklyn Heights, New York, with, you know, pretending to be an auctioneer while people tearfully, you know, hysterically threw money and jewelry into the collection baskets to pay for the girls' freedom. He sent rifles, a whole squadron of rifles, to the Kansas settlers who were fighting against the pro-slavery ruffians, which, of course, got him huge backlash in the press for being a minister advocating violence, as far as everyone else is concerned. And the Bible, the rifles got nicknamed Beecher's Bibles. So that's the kind of thing that he was, a hot-button publicity man, even more than he was really a political thinker.
And that, I'm sure, would lead people to question the depth of his commitment to these issues.
Well, you know, people don't always look past the surface. And I think, yes, some of the more radical abolitionists definitely thought he wavered too much and he was too accommodationist. But most people, they couldn't see past the pyrotechnics. So he actually had quite, he was a scourge in the South, hated in the South.
We have talked about the fact that now, again, that the Beecher family, that Lyman Beecher had all these kids, and that they were really, they were achievers, all of them. They went on to mm-hmm. do important things in progressive social ways, not just the men, but also the women of the family as well, like Harriet Beecher Stowe. One of the things, though, that you write in the book is that of all of the Beecher children, it seems that Henry's success was the most surprising.
Well, you know, in a competitive family with that many kids, he was a middle child. He was playful. What he wanted to do was play. What he wanted was love. He was not a bad kid, but he was one of those kids who was a cut-up, who was always getting in trouble, always skipping school. And, you know, had he had his way, there's not a chance he would have gone to the ministry. I think he would have become a writer or a newspaper man, or I think he secretly wanted to be a politician. And in fact, at one point, there was some talk much later in life that he might go on to politics, but that was cut short by his big scandal.
Yeah. He was always, all throughout his life, he was very close to his sister, Harriet. Okay. How important was that relationship?
Oh, well, you know, the mother of the family died when Henry was three, and so his sisters, especially Harriet, who was closest to him in age, were crucial to making him feel loved. He was very much doted on, and he, for that reason, was always a big fan of women, always very close to a lot of women, really respected them, really advocated for their ability to work in the marketplace, for their intellectual ability to go to school, and he was one of a very big advocate for the right for women to vote, which was pretty shocking at the time.
Yeah. You really, given that Lyman Beecher was a Protestant preacher of the fire and brimstone brand, and maybe the last one, the last really great one like that in America, it makes you wonder why it is that Henry was so, that his kind of practice, his view of God, his kind of Christianity was just almost completely the opposite.
Well, I'll
tell you how that kind of thing happened.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of mystery that can keep a biographer up at night for a long time. Let me tell you from my own experience. But you know, in the end, I finally got it. Lyman Beecher, in the pulpit, was a dogmatist. He was a fire and brimstone thrower. But in his private life, at home, he was the most tender, the most loving father you could imagine. I mean, enough so that he makes a classic 1950s dad look terribly cold. He was just so devoted to his children, and so warm, so fun, and loving, that I think what happened is Beecher eventually decided in his 20s, when he began preaching for himself, that he could not imagine a God who was any less unconditional in his love than his own father. He could not imagine a father, a God who was any less loving, any less supportive than his own father. And so I think it was a situation of do what he said, do as he did rather than as he said. And a funny tension that he did not take up what his father preached, but he sort of created God in his father's image.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that it would be that would end up not really an act of rebellion, not really a rejection of his father in a sense, but an embracing of the kind of father that he was, but the kind of father that he was not in his public role,
that's
but
right.
in his private role.
And, you know, and it's for that reason that he couldn't disappoint him to begin with. You know, he just, much as he didn't really, he really wanted to run away to the sea rather than go into the ministry. But, you know, it's a hard thing when your father is that loving to reject him.
Mm-hmm. He started out, his first church was apparently in a small town in southeastern Indiana.
That's right.
In a place, it's close, to, apparently close to the place where Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky all kind of come together.
Lawrenceburg.
And it was pretty much a rough, I suppose you would say would have been a frontier town at the time. It was nothing glamorous or nothing glorious. It seems like it was a rather inauspicious start to what became a very big career.
And his family was mystified why he would take, you know, he was a beecher. He could have gotten all kinds of positions. And he had gone to seminary. His father established a seminary in Cincinnati, Ohio, and at the time, Cincinnati, you know, the Queen City of the West, a very sophisticated place. The idea of going to Indiana, and you'll have to pardon me for saying this, I know there are probably some Hoosiers out there, but Indiana was considered the worst state in the Union. Swampy, terrible roads, had a reputation for the worst roads in all of America. Barely settled. Everyone wanted to go on to Illinois, which seemed a little more civilized. You know, there were Native Americans living there until just before Henry moved in and when they were driven out. And so going there in the late 1830s was really like going to the Wild West. And he unfortunately brought his Yankee bride out there, who really could hardly have hated it more, frankly. Everyone out west in Indiana thought she was putting on airs with her Yankee manners, and she just couldn't believe what she'd gotten herself into.
Mm-hmm. He went on from there. He was in Lawrenceburg, then he went to Indianapolis, and then it was after that that he went to Brooklyn, to the Plymouth Church, where he would become so famous and so many people would go there to hear him. And, you know, one wonders if how much of his getting that job, and that would be a significant post and a big move up, how much was that people there saw something in him that they liked, and how much of that was the fact that he was the son of Lyman Beecher. And so his name would be very significant.
Well, it's really both. Going out to Indianapolis was where he really kick-started his career. It was the capital city. I mean, it wasn't much of a city, I think, around the time. There were maybe 3,000 people. But it was the hot spot in Indiana by far, where all the courts and all the legislature were. And he gained regional fame there. He spoke at camp meetings. He spoke to the politicians. Any visitor who came through Indianapolis would be likely to stop at his church just to see, you know, well, this young preacher I've heard so much about. And, of course, to hear the Beecher name, you know, that to see what a Beecher really looked like. And that's how he was discovered. It was a traveler coming, a businessman out traveling in Indianapolis. And they brought him back to Brooklyn, which was itself at the time barely a past the village stage. So one of the nice things about Beecher that was fun about writing him is that he was at all the hot spots of history. He was like Zelig or Forrest Gump. You know, everywhere you look, the Taming of the Wild West, the rise of New York as the capital of America unofficially, at every point, there he was, somehow finding the most interesting place to be.
Mm. We're at our midpoint here. Let me just again introduce our guest, Debbie Applegate. She is the author of a recently published biography of Henry Ward Beecher, and she titles her book The Most Famous Man in America. It's published by Doubleday, and certainly in his time he was very famous. Now when people hear the name, they maybe associate him with his sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and certainly in her time she was famous, and that was a very, very well-known book, but also her brother was indeed very famous. Now, he's been in some sense forgotten, not as well known as he once was. And that a lot of Debbie Applegate's interest in writing this book was to again familiarize people with Henry Beecher and who he was and his kind of impact on American culture. So the book is out now. If you would like to take a look at it, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You apparently have been interested in Henry and have been writing about him, have been researching his life for quite a few years now, going back to the time that I think that you were an undergraduate.
That's right. I stumbled upon, I actually had, of course, no idea who he was. I had never even read Uncle Tom's Cabin, although I had heard of her. But I was an undergraduate. I had a scholarship at Amherst College, which happened to be Beecher's alma mater, and I had to do a little exhibit on him in the college library where I had a job, a student job. And I thought, gee, I've never, you know, I had grown up in a very mixed religious background. My mother's side is Mormon. My father's side is Irish Catholic. I lived in an area that was a big part of the rise of the religious right, with a lot of evangelical churches. And I had just never seen a religious figure who was funny and irreverent and flamboyant and genuinely lovable. So I thought, I'll write a paper on that. Well, maybe I'll write my senior thesis. And I thought, well, I'm enjoying this. I'll go to graduate school. I'll write about him for my dissertation. I am still, though, shocked that I really spent this much time, almost 20 years, actually. I hate to say age myself, but almost 20 years since I was 18 have I been working on him. And if I had known when I signed this book contract that it was going to take me 7 years to finish it, I might well have lost courage, I think.
Mm-hmm. We have talked to explain about the fact that his father was a very, very well-known minister, and that he had seven sons and he wanted all of them to be ministers. And so Henry did, even though if he had had his druthers, he might have done something else. But he did, in fact, become a minister, and he had this small town church in Indiana, went to Indianapolis, then went to New York, and over that time grew and bloomed into this great speaker. So by the time that he was at Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, thousands of people came to hear him speak. And so many people would go that apparently the ferry that ran from Manhattan to Brooklyn came to be known, or the Sunday ones came to be known informally as Beecher boats, because everybody was wanting to go there and hear him. And a lot of other equally famous, maybe more famous Americans, people like Walt Whitman and Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln and countless other people went there to hear him. What was he like? What would it have been like if you would have had the opportunity to go there and sit on a Sunday in Plymouth Church and hear him preach?
Well, first of all, you genuinely would have had to fight your way through hundreds of people. The church could seat 3,000, including standing room only. This is obviously before modern fire regulations, and there were always, you know, hundreds of people turned away. So if you were coming from Manhattan, as so many people did, you would be among the crowds. And as you got off, one of the common things was, you know, people would ask, well, how do I get to Beecher's Church from the ferry? And the standard answer was, just follow the crowd. It was a local joke, a bitter kind of joke for those who didn't love having thousands of people descend on every Sunday. He was, and it was unusual because he built his church himself, or he had it built for him specifically, and it did not have a traditional pulpit. It did not have a raised pulpit that would keep you like behind a podium. It was built as a stage, and he would roam across the stage. He did not use notes. He spoke pretty much off the cuff, and in which was always his better way. You know, if he had to be more formal, he was never as good as when he would get himself worked up. Mark Twain described him as marching across the stage, acting like an actor. He was very dramatic. He would, he could do imitations. He did all the time. He had a remarkable understanding of human nature and was more than willing to talk about people in mixed terms, as not all good and not all bad. So he was like an actor in many ways. He full of pyrotechnics. And as Mark Twain described him, marching across the stage, sawing his arms in the air, stamping his foot three times for emphasis, and just mesmerizing the crowd. Although, as Twain also added, when he was homely as a singed cat when he wasn't doing anything, but very charismatic when he was actually up there speaking. So people would cry, people would laugh. I mean, it was really, half the time people went just to see how other people were going to respond to Beecher because he was so theatrical.
Yeah. That is theatrical. That's the word that somehow seems to come to mind when you hear these kind of descriptions or you hear that story that you told earlier about the fact that he brought the young slave girl in and staged what I hope people will understand that what we were really talking about was what he was doing was he was saying to the crowd, can we put together enough money so essentially we can buy this woman and give her her freedom? That was the deal. But it was a very, when you read the description of him doing it and how he addressed the crowd and how he brought her up and that it was indeed very theatrical. It was in some sense a performance. Not that he wasn't sincere about it, but indeed it was a performance.
Well, and he did that also not just to free the girls, but also to give slavery a human face to all these Northerners who actually didn't know very much about slavery, maybe had never seen a slave. He did it to make them slaves seem human rather than like chattel, and it, to see a beautiful young woman who often was very light-skinned, so that you could picture her as your daughter. And he would ask people, imagine what you would feel if your daughter was being sold into a life of labor and beatings and rape. And that was that's what was radical, was to ask people to feel about slaves or about black people in general the way they would about their own white children or their own white family members, and it really was something to see. But of course, the theatricality also got him lots of criticism. Plymouth Church was also known as Beecher's Theater, and people often, ridiculed him as somebody who really should have gone on the stage. And had he become an actor, there is no doubt in my mind he would have been one of the top actors in the country.
Yeah. Let's talk about his relationship with his wife. And clearly it was not a happy marriage. Although, as you mentioned, they managed to have 10 children. Six of them died. And we haven't yet gotten to the big scandal part of the story, but clearly she must have been aware that he was not faithful to her. How did they happen to marry in the first place?
Well, Beecher was, as someone who was raised with, his mother had died, his stepmother was very cool. He was raised around a bevy of intelligent, lively young sisters. He really was, those are the circumstances to be what I think we might technically call girl crazy. Even from the time that he was the littlest boy, he was just girl crazy and flirtatious and warm and the kind of guy that seemed both manly, boyish, masculine, but also would talk about poetry, would talk about flowers, very attractive to women despite his kind of homely visage. But Eunice, his wife, a Massachusetts girl, was frankly the first girl who paid any attention to him. He was 17 when they met, and they got engaged almost right away, and it was a long engagement because then he went out west for seminary. And I think, one of the things I really feel like the book was a lesson on is early marriages can, when you're not mature enough to know who you really are, can be really disastrous. And the problem was they were just the opposite types, where he was confident, friendly, outgoing, easygoing. She was a little sour. She was very jealous. She was, very prim and austere in many ways. On the other hand, she did get the short end of the stick because, you know, it's not easy even now having a minister for a husband. You have to share him with everyone. And then to have her husband become so famous and so in demand, it was very difficult for her. And that really began, and losing all those children, also very difficult for a marriage. Hard to imagine the kind of pressure that puts on a marriage.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the big scandal story, the Beecher Tilton story. He had that, I guess we can say with some confidence, that he had affairs with three women. It's possible there might have been others, but certainly it's pretty clear he had affairs with these three women. He probably fathered a child with one of them. But the one that really got the attention was his alleged affair with the wife of a friend and associate. His name was Theodore Tilton. Her name was Elizabeth Tilton. It's a pretty complicated story that ultimately involves some of the leading figures in the women's rights movement of the time, the first wave of the women's movement. Tell us the story of the Beecher Tilton affair.
Well, you know, it's an extension, as many people observed, of the gospel of love in some ways. And it all bound up, I mean, very interesting to write about because the politics, the religion, and the sex were really all intertwined. Theodore Tilton was Beecher's very close friend and associate. He was his assistant for many years when Beecher worked on a newspaper, a religious newspaper. And his wife, Elizabeth, was one of Beecher's most pious parishioners. And they were all very involved in both the anti-slavery movement, and then when that passed, that day passed, they moved on to the women's movement. And part of what was going was an extension of that girl craziness, that flirtatiousness. Beecher just adored a company of women. Unfortunately, Theodore Tilton, and he began to have tensions, political tensions. They clashed over how Reconstruction would go in the post-Civil War period. They clashed over all kinds of political things where they used to agree. And I think part of Beecher's decision to begin visiting Elizabeth Tilton while her husband was off at work was not just that he knew Elizabeth loved him, you know, admired him in the way you can only admire a man of God who, if you're so pious, but also a little bit to get back at her husband. And what is accused of happening is that Elizabeth Tilton confessed to her husband that they had had an affair, but then immediately retracted it when Beecher asked her to retract it. So already from the very beginning, it starts out with an allegation, an immediate retraction, and that is just followed over and over again by all kinds of confusing testimony where each, both Henry and Elizabeth, each contradicted themselves as well as each other. But once it came out between the couples, excuse me, not Eunice. Eunice had no idea. They decided to cover it up because, you know, once Theodore had confronted Henry, it was a lot of money involved. There was a lot of prestige involved, a lot of political causes. They decided they were going to hush it up. But in the end, a magnificent wild card entered their precarious little cover-up, a woman named Victoria Woodhull, who is now remembered as the first woman to run for the United States presidency, the first woman to have a seat on Wall Street. She was also a spiritual clairvoyant, you know, a psychic who believed she heard voices from beyond the grave. She also was a free love advocate at a time when there could hardly be anything more shocking than free love. And she got wind of the scandal. She got to know all the players a little bit. And when they did not support her candidacy for the presidency, she decided she was going to spill the beans. And when she did, it burst like a bombshell on the country.
Yeah. So she went public about this. It actually came down heavy on her because she was arrested.
Yeah, right.
Then
you've been reading closely.
then subsequently, though, then Theodore Tilton actually sued Henry Beecher, and this thing actually went to trial. There was a trial. This was in 1875, and this was, I guess, it there's always some trial of the century, but this was something that had enormous attention, got great deal of media coverage, was a very big news event.
It actually had more headlines, more newspaper headlines than the Civil War itself did. And I have to have a caveat there that there was, of course, a news blackout during the Civil War, and the number of newspapers skyrocketed after the war. But nonetheless, it is true. There were papers from as far away as San Francisco sent correspondents. It was really where a lot of the modern reporting, the idea of reporters who were objective reporters who would go out and gather stories and bring them back, it was one of the where that idea kind of cut its teeth, and a lot of the journalists who would go on to become so influential later in the century actually cut their teeth on the scandal. It was a madhouse every day. Brooklyn, thousands of people descending, and just as famous people came to see Beecher in the pulpit, they also came to see him on trial. Mark Twain came, politicians came. It was as much a show as any as you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm.
So it seems that if you looked at who really suffered the most, you would have to say the Tiltons both did. Maybe Victoria Woodhull did. The trial ended in a hung jury, but you know, one wonders exactly what did that mean for Henry's from that point on. What did it mean for his reputation?
Well, and it is a sad, you know, by the end of the book, I have to say, Theodore Tilton, in my judgment, I think is correct. Because it was a hung jury, and because it's sexual in its nature, and it was secret, you know, we will never know entirely for sure. But I think the evidence very strongly suggests that Beecher was guilty and that Theodore Tilton was right in his accusation. And after the trial, it is also true that Elizabeth Tilton reversed herself one more time and made a public statement that, in fact, she had been lying and that she had an affair with Beecher. But, of course, by that point, nobody knew what to believe from her, and so it didn't really change anyone's minds. But it is also true that, boy, nobody likes the messenger of bad news. And so Theodore, his reputation was ruined. Elizabeth also pretty much ruined. They separated and lived the rest of their life pretty much as hermits. Victoria Woodhull managed, after getting out of prison, hightailed it out of the country pretty quickly and managed to marry a nobleman in England. But Beecher actually thrived. He lived 10 more years after that until 1887. His church stood by him entirely. Eunice, his wife, stood by him. She went every day to trial, even when he didn't go. His church was so supportive that they voted him a bonus of $100,000 to pay for his legal bills. Now, of course, many of his lawyers were also members of the church, so that was probably a little self-serving. But it meant that he could go on. He could continue to have a career. And in fact, he went on a couple of major speaking tours of the country, and even though the crowds began hostile, they would often boo or spit or hiss or even threaten violence when he would arrive, he won them over every single time and ended up actually really making a small fortune in the last 10 years of his life as a speaker.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of calls I'll get right to. Just very quickly, let me reintroduce our guest, Debbie Applegate. She's the author of a recently published book, The Most Famous Man in America. It's a biography of Henry Ward Beecher, very well known in his time, minister, public speaker, abolitionist, advocate of women's rights, particularly the women's right to vote, and the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who is now much less well known than his sister, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, but certainly was quite well known, quite a famous figure in his time. And
even in the day, people occasionally introduced him as the Reverend Harriet Beecher Stowe. I mean, Henry Ward Beecher Stowe. So he would be used to it, I think.
This guy
now.
Over here, you know, that's Harriet's brother.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
We have a couple of callers here, and we will get to them. Champaign County has first, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about the sort of the timeline and you portrayed his sort of rebellion against his father, but what about the whole tenor of the times? You mentioned he was a speaker on the route. the Great Awakening, which was seen as opening in some ways, but it was extremely puritanical in some other ways at that time. They had a surgical solution for chronic masturbation, for God's sake. But I wanted you to kind of, if you could, find some way to talk about, the broader strokes. Yeah. I assume this was an undermining of the Gospel of Gush, too, everybody would say.
Yeah.
This is where it really leads. But exactly. The other thing is sort of an incidental thing, and then I'll have to hang on and listen if I could, because I'm in a place where I can't get radio right now. Is the Tilton, any connection to Governor Tilton of New York, who was involved in the contested election of 1876 that had to do with the betrayal, formally betraying the Reconstruction?
He was not part of that, but he was not related in that case. Although Beecher did have he was so politically involved that he actually had a little bit to do with that that election. But to go back to your former question, it's one of the things that was most important to me in the book is to make it not just a lively psychological thriller about this man, but also to really illuminate the times, because the time, we tend to idealize the past, and in fact, the 19th century was more bigoted, more violent, more immoral in some ways than we could even possibly imagine today. Beecher, this is the important thing. Beecher was a leader, but he was a popular leader in religious thought. There were many theologians, there were many ministers on the ground pushing many similar ideas like this, that really what you see, the difference between that Old Testament sovereign God and the God of the Son, the Gospel of Love, is it's a gradual move to a more democratic idea, a more humanitarian idea of God. Nobody expected God to be a democrat in the colonial period. They expected God to be a capricious and total sovereign, just like a king. And nobody expected him to be humane. God didn't need to be humane. He could smite you and torture you if he chose to. That was his will. And to suggest that God needed to be bound by the ethics or laws of human life was considered quite blasphemous. So in some ways, the revolution that Beecher and his peers led, some leading it at a more high level intellectually, but Beecher leading it at a very popular level, is he was trying to bring the image of God into a more modern sense of how he understood things. It just didn't seem to people that a good God could also be capricious. If a ruler on earth, tried to punish you because of the sins of your father, like, for example, original sin, that was one of the big points of contestation. It, to Beecher and to many people, it seemed crazy that God would punish you because Adam and Eve ate an apple. That seemed unjust. And I think some of what Beecher is not such a brilliant thinker that he would have come up with all those things by himself. He was really reflecting the changing understanding of life that was going on at the time.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go to line number two, and this is Urbana for our next. Hello.
Hello. You may have talked about this earlier because I haven't been able to hear the whole program, but I wonder what his attitude was toward, say, other social problems, say, poverty and social welfare, and in the attitude of the times, of course, socialism was developing, and labor movement and labor unions, and just wonder if you could shed his views on that sort of thing.
That's a really, really good question. He was, because he was sort of so much of a populist in his instincts, he was very early on always a great friend to the working man, and in particular to the working woman, who was often ignored. He early on was a supporter of laws limiting work days to 8 hours, anti-child, child labor, that sort of thing. He was very supportive of many early workers, unions or trade unions. But And he became a little more conservative later in life. But even still, and during the time when the 1870s, when a lot of these issues about industrialism and labor came to a head and there were waves of very bloody strikes all across the United States, Beecher felt very ambivalent. He's such an optimist that he had a hard time accepting the idea that there might be a fundamental clash between labor and capital. He really could not go with a sort of the communist or socialist critique, but at the same time, as the strikes went on, he really started to realize, oh, this is not this. There is something terrible going on here. There is real injustice, and he began to modify his views. He was. It dovetails, although he did get in a big lot of trouble by preaching about the strikes, the railroad strikes of 1877, he speaks off the top of his head. So after lambasting the robber barons and the railroad owners, he then moves on to the workers and said, you know, any man who can't live on a dollar a day isn't fit to live. Well, you can imagine what kind of flack he got for that. So he was, you know, like everything. He was bold in his pronouncements, but often moderate in his instincts, and just so also with the labor movement. But in the end, really very supportive in a way that I think was pretty admirable, actually.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're almost to the point where we have to stop, unfortunately. Let me ask you a question that you yourself pose here. We're near the end of the book, and that is, was Henry Ward Beecher a great man?
Oh, I have to say I really think he was, but I think his greatness stemmed from his flaws, and his greatness was there because of his flaws. People loved him. People flocked to see him for 30 years because they felt like here was a tremendously human man who was larger than life and allowing them to work out their own vision of what life, the complications of life. I don't think he would have been driven to such heights had he not had such deep flaws. And that is in and of itself really something you don't get to see in celebrities. I close in my mind all the time when I think about that question with a quote from Walt Whitman, who was a great admirer of Beecher, who said, do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes.
It's a very, very interesting story. He sounded like a very interesting man, and I would recommend the book. If you know nothing about Henry Ward Beecher, other than he was the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, you will enjoy the book and learn a lot about him and about America of the time. It's The Most Famous Man in America by our guest Debbie Applegate. It's published by Doubleday. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, such a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 interview first broadcast earlier this year. It comes from the Focus Archives. If you'd like to hear some past programs you might have missed or listen to interviews from the Afternoon Magazine or any other of our local production, you can go to that website anytime that you like. It's will.uiuc.edu. We hope that you will enjoy the rest of your day. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
It's about 1 minute before 12 o'clock noon Central Time. This is AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. My name is Jason Croft, in for the vacationing Celeste Quinn, coming up in the 1 o'clock hour today. Guest host Rita Schulte will be talking with Larry Keller, owner of Wild Birds, Inc. in Champaign. They'll be talking about fall bird feeding and observing. So tune in at 106 for that. Right now, let's take a look at what's going on the Board of Trade and the Merck. First stop, Kansas City September week. It's in fast-track trading, 456, that up 5. Moving on to Chicago.